content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Why America Abandoned the Greatest Economy in History, by Roge Karma. If there is one statistic that best captures the transformation of the American economy over the past half century, it may be this. Of Americans born in 1940, 92% went on to earn more than their parents. Among those born in 1980, just 50% did. Over the course of a few decades, the achieving of the American dream went from a near guarantee to a coin flip. What happened? One answer is that American voters abandoned the system that worked for their grandparents. From the 1940s through the 70s, sometimes called the New Deal era, U.S. law and policy were engineered to ensure strong unions, high taxes on the rich, huge public investments, and an expanding social safety net. Inequality shrank as the economy boomed. But by the end of that period, the economy was faltering, and voters turned against the post-war consensus. Ronald Reagan took office promising to restore growth by paring back government, slashing taxes on the rich and corporations, and gutting business regulations and antitrust enforcement. The idea, famously, was that a rising tide would lift all boats. Instead, inequality soared while living standards stagnated and life expectancy fell behind that of peer countries. No other advanced economy pivoted quite as sharply to free market economics as the United States, and none experienced as sharp a reversal in income, mobility, and public health trends as America did. Today, a child born in Norway or in the United Kingdom has a far better chance of out-earning their parents than one born in the U.S. This story has been extensively documented, but a nagging puzzle remains. Why did America abandon the New Deal so decisively? And why did so many voters and politicians embrace the free market consensus that replaced it? Since 2016, policymakers, scholars, and journalists have been scrambling to answer those questions as they seek to make sense of the rise of Donald Trump, who declared in 2015, "The American dream is dead," and the seething discontent in American life. Three main theories have emerged, each with its own account of how we got here and what it might take to change course. One theory holds that the story is fundamentally about the white backlash to civil rights legislation. Another pins more blame on the Democratic Party's cultural elitism. And the third focuses on the role of global crises beyond any political party's control. Each theory is incomplete on its own. Taken together, they go a long way toward making sense of the political and economic uncertainty we're living through. The American landscape was once graced with resplendent public swimming pools, some big enough to hold thousands of swimmers at a time, writes Heather McGee, the former president of the think tank Demos, in her 2021 book, The Sum of Us. In many places, however, the pools were also whites only. Then came desegregation. Rather than open up the pools to their black neighbors, white communities decided to simply close them for everyone. For McGee, that is a microcosm of the changes to America's political economy over the past half century. White Americans were willing to make their own lives materially worse rather than share public goods with black Americans. From the 1930s until the late 60s, Democrats dominated national politics. They used their power to pass sweeping progressive legislation that transformed the American economy. But their coalition, which included Southern Dixiecrats as well as Northern liberals, fractured after President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Richard Nixon's Southern strategy exploited that rift and changed the electoral map. Since then, no Democratic presidential candidate has won a majority of the white vote. Crucially, the Civil Rights Revolution also changed white Americans' economic attitudes. In 1956, 65% of white people said they believed the government ought to guarantee a job to anyone who wanted one and to provide a minimum standard of living. By 1964, that number had shrunk to 35%. Ronald Reagan eventually channeled that backlash into a free market message by casting high taxes and generous social programs as funneling money from hardworking white Americans to undeserving black welfare queens. In this telling, which has become popular on the left, Democrats are the tragic heroes. The mid-century economy was built on racial suppression and torn apart by racial progress. Economic inequality was the price liberals paid to do what was right on race. The New York Times writer David Leonhardt is less inclined to let liberals off the hook. His new book, Ours Was the Shining Future, contends that the fracturing of the New Deal coalition was about more than race. Through the 50s, the left was rooted in a broad working class movement focused on material interests. But at the turn of the 60s, a new left emerged that was dominated by well-off college students. These activists were less concerned with economic demands than issues like nuclear disarmament, women's rights, and the war in Vietnam. Their methods were not those of institutional politics, but civil disobedience and protest. The rise of the new left, Leonhardt argues, accelerated the exodus of white working class voters from the Democratic coalition. Robert F. Kennedy emerges as an unlikely hero in this telling. Although Kennedy was a committed supporter of civil rights, he recognized that Democrats were alienating their working class base. As a primary candidate in 1968, he emphasized the need to restore law and order and took shots at the new left, opposing draft exemptions for college students. As a result of these and other centrist stances, Kennedy was criticized by the liberal press, even as he won key primary victories on the strength of his support from both white and black working-class voters. But Kennedy was assassinated in June that year, and the political path he represented died with him. That November, Nixon, a Republican, narrowly won the White House. In the process, he reached the same conclusion that Kennedy had. The Democrats had lost touch with the working class, leaving millions of voters up for grabs. In the 1972 election, Nixon portrayed his opponent, George McGovern, as the candidate of the three A's, acid, abortion, and amnesty, the latter referring to draft dodgers. He went after Democrats for being soft on crime and unpatriotic. On election day, he won the largest landslide since Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1936. For Leonhardt, that was the moment when the New Deal coalition shattered. From then on, as the Democratic Party continued to reflect the views of college graduates and professionals, it would lose more and more working-class voters. McGee's and Leonhardt's accounts might appear to be in tension, echoing the race versus class debate that followed Trump's victory in 2016. In fact, they're complementary. As the economist Thomas Piketty has shown, since the 1960s, left-leaning parties in most Western countries, not just the U.S., have become dominated by college-educated voters and lost working-class support. But nowhere in Europe was the backlash quite as immediate and intense as it was in the U.S. A major difference, of course, is the country's unique racial history. The 1972 election might have fractured the Democratic coalition, but that still doesn't explain the rise of free market conservatism. The new Republican majority did not arrive with a radical economic agenda. Nixon combined social conservatism with a version of New Deal economics. His administration increased the funding for Social Security and food stamps, raised the capital gains tax, and created the Environmental Protection Agency. Meanwhile, laissez-faire economics remained unpopular, polls from the 1970s found that most Republicans believe that taxes and benefits should remain at present levels, and anti-tax ballot initiatives failed in several states by wide margins. Even Reagan largely avoided talking about tax cuts during his failed 1976 presidential campaign. The story of America's economic pivot still has a missing piece. According to the economic historian Gary Gerstle's 2022 book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, that piece is the severe economic crisis of the mid-1970s. The 1973 Arab oil embargo sent inflation spiraling out of control. Not long afterward, the economy plunged into recession. Median family income was significantly lower in 1979 than it had been in the beginning of the decade, adjusting for inflation. These changing economic circumstances, coming on the heels of the divisions over race and Vietnam, broke apart the New Deal order, Gerstle writes. Leonhard also discusses the economic shocks of the 70s, but they play a less central role in his analysis. Free market ideas had been circulating among a small cadre of academics and business leaders for decades, most notably the University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman. The 70s crisis provided a perfect opening to translate them into public policy, and Reagan was the perfect messenger. "Government is not the solution to our problem," he declared in his 1981 inaugural address. "Government is the problem." Part of Reagan's genius was that the message meant different things to different constituencies. For Southern whites, government was forcing school desegregation. For the religious right, government was licensing abortion and preventing prayer in schools. And for working-class voters, who bought Reagan's pitch, a bloated federal government was behind their plummeting economic fortunes. At the same time, Reagan's message tapped into genuine shortcomings with the economic status quo. The Johnson administration's heavy spending had helped ignite inflation, and Nixon's attempt at price controls had failed to quell it. The generous contracts won by auto unions made it hard for American manufacturers to compete with non-unionized Japanese ones. After a decade of pain, most Americans now favored cutting taxes. The public was ready for something different. They got it. The top marginal income tax rate was 70% when Reagan took office and 28% when he left. Union membership shriveled. Deregulation led to an explosion of the financial sector, and the Reagan Supreme Court appointment set the stage for decades of consequential pro-business rulings. None of this, Gerstle argues, was preordained. The political tumult of the 60s helped crack the Democrats' electoral coalition, but it took the unusual confluence of a major economic crisis and a talented political communicator to create a new consensus. By the 90s, Democrats had accommodated themselves to the core tenets of the Reagan Revolution. President Bill Clinton further deregulated the financial sector, pushed through the American Free Trade Agreement, and signed a bill designed to end welfare as we know it. Echoing Reagan in his 1996 State of the Union address, Clinton conceded, "The era of big government is over." Today, we seem to be living through another inflection point in American politics, one that in some ways resembles the 60s and 70s. Then and now, previously durable coalitions collapsed, new issues surged to the fore, and policies once considered radical became mainstream. Political leaders in both parties no longer feel the same need to bow at the altar of free markets and small government. But also like the 70s, the current moment is defined by a sense of unsolved contestation. Although many old ideas have lost their hold, they have yet to be replaced by a new economic consensus. The old order is crumbling, but a new one has yet to be born. The Biden administration and its allies are trying to change that. Since taking office, President Joe Biden has pursued an ambitious policy agenda designed to transform the U.S. economy and has taken overt shots at Reagan's legacy. Milton Friedman isn't running the show anymore, Biden quipped in 2020. Yet an economic paradigm is only as strong as the political coalition that backs it. Unlike Nixon, Biden has not figured out how to cleave apart his opponent's coalition. And unlike Reagan, he hasn't hit upon the kind of grand political narrative needed to forge a new one. Current polling suggests he may struggle to win re-election. Meanwhile, the Republican Party struggles to muster any coherent economic agenda. A handful of Republican senators, including J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and Josh Hawley, have embraced economic populism to some degree, but they remain a minority within their party. The path of our chaotic present to a new political economic consensus is hard to imagine, but that has always been true of moments of transition. In the early 70s, no one could have predicted that a combination of social upheaval, economic crisis, and political talent was about to usher in a brand new economic era. Perhaps the same is true today. The Reagan Revolution is never coming back. Neither is the New Deal order that came before it. Whatever comes next will be something new. Next, The Airplane Wants to Fly by Patrick Chovanec. In May 2022, an air traffic controller in Florida received a frantic call. The pilot of a single-engine Cessna 208 had collapsed, leaving the sole passenger, with no experience at all flying a plane, to fend for himself in the cockpit. Remarkably, the controller was able to direct the passenger to take the controls, reach an airport, and safely land. The story went viral for several days, perhaps in part because we can all imagine ourselves in that nightmare come true. Could we figure out what to do? Would we live to tell the tale? In the past, I would have asked myself those same questions. But this time I had answers, and I knew I was up to the challenge of landing a plane. At age 52, I had just earned my pilot's license. All my life, I assumed that flying an airplane was something other people were born to do, not me. Then during the pandemic lockdowns, my life took an unexpected turn. Unable to go on a trip, something I loved doing, I turned to traveling virtually. I started playing the newly released Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020 on my PC. As my enjoyment grew, so did my curiosity. I bought an online ground school course, a series of video classes that teach flying basics, to learn more, and took the logical next step. I signed up for real-life flying lessons. My family and friends were slightly puzzled and wondered if I was having some kind of midlife crisis. It shouldn't take a crisis to push us outside our comfort zones, but sometimes it helps. For many of us, the pandemic was a year of disrupted plans and dashed hopes. I heard people talking about a whole year wasted. I hated the sound of that and rebelled at the thought of resigning myself to it. I wasn't trying to fulfill a lifelong dream. I didn't have any fantasies of being Tom Cruise in Top Gun. I just wanted to see what life still had to offer. So I learned to fly. For millennia, humans looked up at the birds in the sky and wondered about flight. Little more than a century ago, we worked out how to do it ourselves. Since then, flying has become a thoroughly mundane, if poorly understood, part of modern life. The key conceptual leap to understanding flight is changing how we think about the air. Because air is invisible and transparent, almost a void, we tend to think of it as lacking substance. In fact, air has a very real substance. Years ago, I stood on a clifftop in Wales and was nearly knocked off my feet by an 80-mile-an-hour gale blowing in from the North Atlantic. The pressure on my face was so intense, it gave me a headache. This is the kind of force that keeps a 560-ton Airbus A380 up in the sky. An airplane is designed to create such airflow and to allow the pilot to manipulate it to move the plane in a desired direction. The trickiest part of flying is that because we can't see how the airflow is interacting with the plane, a pilot must learn how to feel it. This ocean of air that we're surfing in a plane is every bit as changeable as a storm-tossed sea. I'm not talking about the bumps and swoops of typical turbulence. As alarming as those might seem, airplanes are also designed to right themselves in response to an occasional gust. But other conditions, thunderstorms, fog, ice, can pose a real danger, and I was surprised to find how important understanding the weather is for pilots. We passengers get frustrated, maybe even feel incredulous, when our flight gets canceled because of bad weather. It can be hard to believe that mere fog or a thunderstorm could pose a problem for a modern airliner with all its technological gizmos and guidance wizardry. In fact, airlines spent a lot of time and effort trying to plan around weather for both comfort and safety. In the case of a small plane, such as a single-engine Cessna 172 that I learned to fly, the potential hazards are more serious still. As a student pilot, I found myself carefully scanning the weather reports, like the lookout in the crow's nest of a sailing ship watching out for a squall or storm, to decipher the conditions I might face or should avoid altogether. As an old saying among pilots goes, it's better to be on the ground wishing you were in the air than in the air wishing you were on the ground. Sometimes they heed that advice, sometimes they don't. The great killer of new pilots is spatial disorientation. When the weather closes in and you can't see much outside your windshield, you can't trust your own sense of balance and motion. You can feel as though you're flying level when in fact you're spiraling downward in a dive or climbing so slowly and steeply that you're about to stall. That disorientation is what most likely happened to John F. Kennedy Jr. flying through the murky twilight across the dark, featureless ocean to Martha's Vineyard. It's also what contributed to the crash that killed the musicians, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and others as they took off in a small plane with an inexperienced pilot on a snowy night. The solution is to learn how to fly looking only at the instruments in the cockpit. There are six main instruments, including the attitude indicator, the altimeter, and the airspeed indicator, that a pilot learns to recognize and read no matter what kind of aircraft they are flying. A pilot also has to understand how these devices work and how they might malfunction, so as to not be misled by an inaccurate readout. Learning to rely safely on instruments rather than one's senses takes a lot of training, but that's what makes flying possible in less than perfect conditions. During my very first lesson, my instructor told me I'd be performing the takeoff. In fact, taking off is relatively easy. Push the throttle to full power and nudge the rudder pedals left and right to keep the plane pointed straight down the runway. At a designated speed, roughly 68 miles per hour, gently pull back on the yoke and suddenly you're flying. As the instructor will tell you, the plane wants to fly. My instructor in this case was an energetic 20-something woman who was working to become an airline pilot. All but one of the instructors turned out to be women, which makes my experience an outlier. There's no reason flying should be a guy thing, but to a large degree it remains so. As of last year, women accounted for just 6% of licensed pilots in the U.S., 8% of certified instructors, and 5% of airline pilots. For an industry facing a shortage of trained personnel, this represents a huge reservoir of untapped potential. The gender imbalance may be starting to change, albeit slowly. 15% of student pilots now are women, and the women in the aviation are, on average, nearly 8 years younger than the men. Learning to do anything from a teacher half your age is a humbling experience, and being humble is good, because compared with taking off, learning to land a plane takes a lot of practice. An aircraft in flight is full of energy. It wants to fly, after all. And the goal in landing is to run out of that energy just as you've positioned the plane inches above your aim point on the runway. No sooner, no later. Add in a gusty wind blowing the plane sideways and the hard ground rushing up at you, and you'll appreciate how setting the aircraft down is usually the most challenging and scary thing for students to learn. I have to admit, I struggled for a while with my landings. In the end, I took another sort of lesson from my 8-year-old daughter, whom I was teaching to throw and catch a baseball. The ball's trajectory was a mystery to her at first, and she was afraid the ball could hit her. Gradually, she learned to see the ball anew and anticipate where it would be. I realized that's what I had to do, trained my brain to process approaching and landing on the runway, rather than being overwhelmed by the rush of events. It took some work to develop the sense of control, to feel that I was landing the plane, rather than the plane was landing me. The first solo, flying the airplane all by yourself without an instructor alongside you, is the crucible for every new pilot. You get to do it only when your instructor is convinced that you have your landings down. If you're truly ready, the flight itself is almost an anticlimax because every step becomes routine and familiar. Flying parallel to the runway, 1,000 feet in the air, ease the throttle back, lower your flaps, and push the nose down. Announce your last two 90-degree turns over the radio, maintaining a steady descent, as you bank the plane. Line up with the runway and adjust your power if you're too high or too low. Then as you near the beginning of the runway, pull the throttle all the way back to idle and let the plane level off, just as the runway's edges appear to widen. Shifting your line of sight toward the end of the runway, gradually pull back on the yoke as the plane loses speed and lift to make the touchdown as gentle as possible. Bump, bump. Apply the brakes and you've done it. Well, sort of. After your first solo, much remains for you before you get a pilot certificate. You have to learn how to navigate, talk the air traffic control, fly at night, and deal with emergencies. Then make several extended solo flights to prove your mettle. You also have to pass a detailed written exam, and finally a check ride, in which an FAA-appointed pilot examiner puts your aviation knowledge and flying skills to the test. A few weeks after earning my license, I began to write about my experience. As a newcomer to this world, I wanted to offer a window into what learning to fly is really like. The broad and challenging body of knowledge you have to absorb, the skills you must master, the regulatory hoops, and the frustrating setbacks, and yes, the thrill, and sometimes shell-shocked sense of accomplishment you get to feel if you persevere. Many of the early aviators, such as Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, wrote in The Little Prince, waxed lyrical about the wonder of flying, seeing the world for the first time from a bird's-eye view. I discovered that a deeper, more enduring wonder remains. This comes after you no longer shrug off the fact of flying as a given, but hold the controls in your own hands. Then, in that moment, you realize that you are in control of a machine that is defying gravity. Learning to fly is hard, but hard things are worthwhile. I recently heard an interview with actor Harrison Ford, who, like me, became a pilot in his 50s. I really didn't know if I could learn anything, he said, explaining what had driven him to fly. I hadn't learned anything other than lines for a long time. I wanted to engage my brain in some process that would wake it up and resupply it with challenges. We all fly, but in the rush of our lives, we tend to regard it either as a mundane chore or an unapproachable mystery. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.